A historian from the year 2393 explores how climate catastrophe came about.
And the specific question that she's trying to answer is, how was it possible that those people knew so much about what was happening to them, had such detailed scientific evidence, very accurate climate models, correctly predicted what was going to happen, and yet took so little effective action to prevent it?
That's Naomi Oreskes. We talk with her about the speculative novel she co-wrote with Eric Conway, The Collapse of Western Civilization, A View from the Future. Then, the world is preparing for the climate talks and the People's Climate March in New York City next week. So it's a good time to listen back to my 2010 interview with climatologist Dr. James Hansen. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. People all over the world are gearing up for Climate Week, starting with what's being billed as the largest climate march in history, taking place on Sunday, September 21st in New York City. Over the past several weeks, the climate news has gotten both starker and more hopeful. Starker because we've learned that CO2 emissions are rising faster than ever, and more than half of bird species in the U.S. are threatened by global warming. More hopeful because a new report says the costs of fighting climate change will be modest and the gains will far outweigh them. So it's time to act, and we can make a difference. So why don't we? That's a question explored in a new book of science-based speculative fiction by Naomi Oreskes and Eric M. Conway. The year is 2393, and the world is almost unrecognizable. Clear warnings of climate catastrophe went ignored for decades, leading to soaring temperatures, rising sea levels, widespread drought, and finally the disaster now known as the Great Collapse of 2093, when the disintegration of the West Antarctica ice sheet led to mass migration and a complete reshuffling of the global order. Writing from the Second People's Republic of China on the 300th anniversary of the Great Collapse, a senior scholar presents a gripping and deeply disturbing account of how the political and economic elites of the so-called advanced industrial societies failed to act, and so brought about the collapse of Western civilization. That's the blurb from Naomi Oreskes and Eric M. Conway's new book, The Collapse of Western Civilization, A View from the Future. Oreskes and Conway last collaborated on their celebrated book, Merchants of Doubt. She teaches the history of science and earth and planetary sciences at Harvard University. Conway is a historian at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California. Well, Naomi Oreskes, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
This is just a terrific book. You co-wrote it with Eric Conway, also your co-author on Merchants of Doubt. First, give us a setting. A historian from China is looking back from the future, writing a treatise on how and why the world failed to avert climate catastrophe. First, paint for us a portrait of her world, who she is, and how her world got that way.
Well, she is writing from the year 2393, and she lives in the Second People's Republic of China. And she's a historian, and she's been tasked with the project of trying to understand what happened to Western civilization. And the specific question that she's trying to answer is, how was it possible that those people knew so much about what was happening to them, had such detailed scientific evidence, very accurate climate models, really foresaw, correctly predicted what was going to happen, and yet took so little effective action to prevent it? So that's the question. We don't know that many details about the world in which she lives, but one of the things we do know, and it's sort of the central premise of the book, is that the liberal democracies failed to act effectively to respond to the threat when things started to break down, and so authoritarian governments stepped up to the plate, stepped into the fray, and so we have a resurgence of authoritarian government, a renewal of China, that we call that the Second People's Republic, and so she is writing from the position of an authoritarian, a renewed authoritarianism in a future Chinese state.
this idea of the centralized state versus the centralized authoritarian state versus so-called liberal democracy is kind of at the heart of your book. Tell us, what is the problem with so-called liberal democracy? And tell us, what is the nature of that democracy that has so hampered us in being able to deal with climate change?
Well, the point of the book wasn't really so much to say that there's a problem with democracy, although I suppose that's a legitimate reading of it. It was more a kind of, meant to be a sort of cautionary tale, and it arose out of the work that Eric Conway and I did on Merchants of Doubt. One of the central realizations we made in that book, we were trying to understand why would people deny the reality of climate change, and especially why would educated, intelligent people deny it, and really especially why would scientists deny it, because the crux of that book was to look at the role of a small handful of scientists, a small handful of contrarian outlier scientists who made common cause with the fossil fuel industry and also the tobacco industry to deny scientific evidence related not just to climate change, but also to tobacco smoking and other things. And what we realized reading their work, reading their correspondence, was that they thought they were protecting freedom. They were afraid that climate change would be used as an excuse, a kind of lever to a sort of backdoor to socialism, a slippery slope to socialism. And so they opposed action on climate change, and they denied its reality because they were afraid of its implications, afraid that the response to climate change would be the growth of big government, more government intrusion in our lives, less personal liberty. And when Eric and I were reading these materials, we thought, well, this is so ironic, because by delaying action on climate change, they're actually increasing the likelihood of the very things that they don't want, that is to say, intrusive government. And so in the new book, we pick up on that premise, and we imagine, well, what happens if we fail to act on climate change? What happens if catastrophic droughts, like what's going on in California right now, begin to become more common? What happens if, you know, devastating storms like Superstorm Sandy or Hurricane Katrina start to become more common? And the obvious answer is the government calls out the National Guard. The government declares martial law if there are food riots and food shortages. Natural disasters and catastrophes almost inevitably lead to loss of personal liberty. They almost inevitably lead to governments having to take on more responsibility to evacuate people, to deny people the right to go back to those places in some cases if the problem becomes truly severe, to commandeer resources, to take over businesses. All of these things are actually likely outcomes of catastrophic climate change. And so the point of the book is to say, if you care about democracy, if you care about personal liberty, you ought to be on the front lines of demanding action on climate change. Because if we don't act and we allow things to spin out of control, it's not going to be good for personal freedom. It's not going to be good for liberty.
But there's an other player here, which has a very important role to play in terms of weighing on the kind of democracy or liberty we have, and that is market fundamentalism, which is the other twin force here. And you coin a wonderful term, in fact, I think one that really needs to go into the lexicon, and that is the carbon combustion complex. And in Merchants of Doubt, it was the tobacco complex. Here's the carbon.
Tobacco combustion complex. Right?
Yeah, exactly.
Right, exactly. Right. Well, yes, thanks for pointing that out. And we obviously thought a lot about that. So you're absolutely right. So, you know, the word capitalism is a very coarse word because there are many, many different ways in which capitalism can play out. And the reality is no world, no country in the world has a purely free market system. We all have economies that are mixed in some ways, some mixture of government intervention, government regulation, government control, and, you know, free market forces. And different countries have different mixes. One of the problems we face here in the United States today, but it's not only here, it's really everywhere, but it's worse in the United States, is that, you know, we have this incredibly powerful carbon combustion complex led by the fossil fuel industry, but it's not just the fossil fuel industry. And I actually think that's really important, because if it were only the fossil fuel industry, it would be sort of easy for us to say, well, look at these look at these terrible people. Look at what they're doing. They're putting the whole future, the future health, well-being, and prosperity of men and women and children, you know, they're sacrificing that just so that they can, what, drill a little bit more oil and gas? I mean, it's really absolutely unconscionable. So why don't we say that? And why don't we say it's obvious that we need to divest from these corporations, that we need to revoke their social license, we need to make what they're doing unacceptable? Well, because it isn't just ExxonMobil and Chevron and Shell and BP, although they're obviously very important players, but it's also all the other different industries, which is essentially practically everything, that depends on inexpensive fossil fuels. It's plastics and it's transportation, it's aircraft, it's home heating, it's home construction. There really isn't a thing you can name that doesn't use energy. And in the United States, the vast, vast bulk of our energy comes from cheap fossil fuels. So to face that is to face the entire economic basis of the American way of life. And that's a very, very threatening thing. And I think that's a kind of thread that people are afraid to pull, because they're afraid that if they do pull it, the whole fabric could unravel.
That's a very dark view. Do you see no way in which those very industries can become dependent on renewables?
Well, I actually, of course, do. Otherwise, if I thought it was completely hopeless, I'd be a hermit living in the backwoods of New Hampshire. But I wouldn't be talking to you on the phone. So obviously, as I said, this is a cautionary tale. The whole point of writing is to say, it doesn't have to be this way. And so Eric and I are now working on the outline for a kind of anti-collapse, we're calling it, to think about, can we now write the alternative parallel that lays out a picture of what the alternative looks like? And the short answer to that is to say that there's a lot of talk about technological solutions, and people get reactive in both directions, both pro and con. But the reality is that we have the technology we need. We don't need to sit around waiting for some future Thomas Edison or Nikola Tesla to invent some whole new form of energy. What we need is we need to change the incentives to make those forms of energy economic. And that means starting with cutting out all of the amazing, incredible subsidies to fossil fuels. But it also means breaking the power of the fossil fuel industry, and that's a really, really difficult thing. And that's one of the reasons I became involved in the divestment movement at Harvard, because I think we do need to break the power of the fossil fuel industry, and we do need to revoke their social license. And how do we do that? That's a really tough question. Well, one thing we can do is to have conversations like this, and another thing we can do is to say that we won't invest in the continued development of fossil fuels that we know are leading us on the, you know, the track to collapse.
Yeah, exactly. If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Naomi Oreskes about her book, which she co-authored with Eric M. Conway, The Collapse of Western Civilization, A View from the Future. So another fascinating discussion in the book, coming from this historian from the Second People's Republic of China in the year 2323, is what role you could say the culture of science in the Western world, or even in the world today, has played in preventing us to deal head-on with climate change. And we want to say here, it's not as if the scientists who are putting this forward, I mean, they're heroes. James Hansen is one of my great heroes. You do say there's trouble in the scientific world.
Yes. And this is a very interesting point, and as you suggested, it's delicate, because people like Jim Hansen and Steve Schneider, Ben Santer, Mike Mann, these guys are heroes. They've done incredibly great work, and they've paid a personal price for it, and they've been attacked, you know, completely viciously and unscrupulously. So this is not a criticism of any individual scientist, but it is to raise a question about how the scientific community as a whole speaks and communicates about science and thinks about science and thinks about the problem of proof. So one of the things that I became interested in was the question of whether or not scientists had exaggerated the threat of climate change. And as you know, many contrarians, many members of the carbon combustion complex accuse scientists of exaggerating the threat. And this, it turns out, is a very sticky accusation. And I've found when I give public lectures that many people think that this is true. And they think it's true because they think that by exaggerating the threat, scientists get more money for their research. And I thought that was an interesting argument because it could be true, right? By saying that this is a really, really serious problem, scientists could actually get more money for their research. So it's plausible that they might exaggerate the threat. So I decided to test that hypothesis. And I did a study with my postdoc, Kanan Bryce, and a couple of other colleagues, in which we actually looked at a set of climate predictions that had been made 10, 15, 20 years ago, and then compared it to what had actually happened to see whether or not this claim of exaggeration was correct. And we found that it was not correct, that in fact, not only had scientists not exaggerated the threat, that in most cases they had underpredicted it. So things like temperature rise and sea level rise had actually gone at a faster pace than scientists had anticipated. So then we asked the question, well, why? And we started talking about the culture of science and how scientists think about their own behavior. And what we concluded based on interviews with scientists, we found that many, many scientists invoked the metaphor of crying wolf. And they said, we don't want to cry wolf. And it was remarkable how many scientists said that. And when we said to them, we said, well, what about why is it okay to fiddle while Rome burns, but it's not okay to cry wolf? And then they would say things like, well, if we cry wolf, we'll lose our credibility. So within the scientific community, there's this very strong idea that the way scientists remain credible is to do everything possible not to cry wolf. That is to say, the worst possible thing you could do would be to exaggerate. And where does that come from? Well, we developed this hypothesis we call erring on the side of least drama. And what we argue is that the culture of the scientific community is committed to the idea of rationality. And there's a very, very, very deep idea in Western culture that rationality stands in opposition to emotion. We actually know that it's false. There's a lot of good evidence from neuroscience. It's just not even true. But even though it's not true, people believe it, and scientists believe it. So they think that to be scientific, they have to be unemotional. They have to be undramatic, because drama evokes emotion, and emotion, they think, undermines your ability to be rational. And so the argument we made is that the scientific community's commitment to this has actually caused them to underestimate the threat. And we see it played out specifically in the way they deal with things statistically, which is this idea of the 95% confidence limit. The 95% confidence limit says that I don't tell you I believe something unless I'm sure that there's only less than a 1 in 20 chance that that thing could have happened by coincidence. So it's setting this extremely high bar on what it takes to say that, yes, we know that something is true. And that extremely high bar contributes to a kind of scientific reticence. Jim Hansen has called it reticence, a kind of reluctance to stand up and say, yes, we know that this is true. Yes, we know that this is happening. Yes, we know that this is going to be bad, right? Because bad is a value judgment word. So scientists are very afraid to say climate change is bad. And you'll notice that if you interview them, they'll talk about meters of sea level rise, and they'll talk about temperatures above, you know, temperatures degrees C, and they'll talk about parts per million and parts per billion of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, and they'll go on and on and about all kinds of very specific detail. But you'll almost never hear them simply say, and the reason why all this matters is because climate change is really bad, because climate change will hurt people. People will be injured. People will die. And so that, we have come to the conclusion, is really a big problem. So it's not climate scientists' fault that we're in the place we are, but the way they act, the cultural norms of the community, have contributed, we think, to the fact that we haven't taken more dramatic steps to deal with this problem.
Well, that's very interesting. It puts one in mind of the journalism profession, which also was extremely slow to take up the real issue, the real danger and risk of climate change, because it was afraid of being seen as non-objective.
Exactly. There is an interesting parallel. And I get asked about this by journalists a lot. And of course, usually my answer is, well, maybe you should answer that question. You know, it's a little weird for me to be telling journalists, you know, what they've done wrong. But I think that we see this very clearly. And we see it especially in this journalistic ideal of balance. The journalists think that to be balanced is to give equal side, you know, equal time to two sides of an argument. But what Eric Conway and I have always argued is, if you know that one side of that argument is untrue, if you know it's false, if you know that it has been refuted by scientific data, if you know that the questions people are raising have actually been answered, then to give equal time to those claims is actually to present a very incorrect, a very inaccurate view of the reality. So what I usually say to journalists when they ask about it is that journalists should be striving for accuracy. They should not be striving for balance, because in this case, balance turns out to be false equivalence.
Absolutely. But it's so interesting that the kind of inertia that these scientific and journalistic conventions create is always in the service of those who rule, of the carbon combustion complex.
Well, that's right. And it's interesting to stop and think about that. And I think that's great that you raised that, because it would be really, really good if scientists and journalists would actually step back and just think about that point for a minute. Because I'm sure that most journalists would say that they're not intending to aid the carbon combustion complex, that they simply want to be good journalists doing a good job and giving people good information. But the fact is that the journalist world has given the American people very, very bad information over the last 20 years. And it's not just Fox News. Max Boykoff in Colorado has done some wonderful work on this. It's the mainstream media. It's the so-called liberal media. It's the so-called prestige press. We see this problem across the board in journalism, and it has nothing to do, you know, with who the editors of the newspapers and magazines are.
You also skewer some other ideas. Natural gas, the idea of natural gas as a bridge to renewables. We've talked about this on our show here. We've interviewed Richard Heinberg, who's written about that. But if you'd just like to maybe quickly sum up why natural gas is not, in fact, a bridge to renewables.
There's a couple of reasons, but the short answer is, first of all, gas is gas. It's a fossil fuel. And when you burn gas, you put carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. In the fullness of time, there's no way to solve the problem of fossil fuels by burning more fossil fuels. That just simply cannot happen physically. So the question then becomes, why would anyone even think that gas could be beneficial? And the answer is because although it's a fossil fuel, it's not as bad as coal. So if you could replace coal with natural gas, then you could reduce your greenhouse gas production, you know, somewhat. And so many people have made the argument that this is a good first step. That argument would be a good one, in my opinion, if the transition to gas were part of a large-scale energy plan where you had a plan for how you were going to use gas as a transition fuel and how you're going to make sure that within the next 20 or 30 years we convert not just to gas, but in fact to zero carbon or extremely low carbon fuels. We don't have that plan, and no one in the world has that plan. So instead, what we're actually seeing is that natural gas is coming on board, and in many places in the world, it's not replacing coal at all. It's just becoming more fossil fuels to burn. So you're not getting a net benefit in many cases. And then the third reason, I think, is maybe the most important one, is all, well, there's actually four reasons. It's a really complicated issue, and that's why I think a lot of people are confused about it. So I'll give you two more reasons. Third reason is leakage, and there's been a lot written about this. Gas wells leak, and when they leak, the natural gas, which is methane, goes directly to the atmosphere without being burnt. And methane is a much worse greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. If enough methane leaks out of the well and goes to the atmosphere, then any benefit you have relative to coal is completely lost. In fact, it's possible under some conditions that the gas is actually worse than coal. And we have evidence that there are significant numbers of wells in the United States and elsewhere where the leakage rates are so bad that, in fact, it is probably no benefit relative to coal and possibly even worse. So the whole story about gas being better than coal starts to look kind of questionable. It might be better than coal in terms of other benefits, like air pollution benefits, the benefits of not destroying mountaintops. But in terms of greenhouse gases, the benefit is small to negligible. And one final thing, and I think this is the most important thing of all, it has to do with structural issues. When you burn gas, you don't just burn gas. You build wells, you build pipelines, you build houses that are designed to work on natural gas, you build all kinds of infrastructure, export terminals, tankers, you know, pipelines. And that infrastructure isn't built just to last for 10 or 15 or 20 years. It's built to last for 30 or 50 or 100 years. So now we're locking into our infrastructure, into our energy system, a commitment to gas that goes way past the period in which we need to make the bridge to renewables. We need to make this change in our economy in the next 20 to 30 years. All of the scientific evidence says that. We're building infrastructure that commits us to gas for 30, 50, 100 years. So there's a gigantic disconnect between what we need to do and the arguments that are made to justify gas.
Yeah, I believe they call those sunk costs.
Well, right, exactly. The actual money you spend is a sunk cost, so now you want to recoup it. The infrastructure you build, historians of technology call this the infrastructure trap, that once you build infrastructure, because you have invested so much money in it, you've sunk so much money into it, now you're committed to using that infrastructure, and if you want to change it, it then becomes very difficult and very expensive. It becomes financially expensive because you spent all this money, and it becomes socially and politically difficult because now you have, you know, whole armies of people. You now have a gas combustion complex that will fight to defend gas, even if it's not in the interest of the larger society.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Naomi Oreskes about her book, which she co-authored with Eric M. Conway, The Collapse of Western Civilization, A View from the Future. And talking about costs, as we're talking now, there was a report, I believe yesterday or the day before, that said that not only will the transition to renewables not cost us, it will actually save us money, it will create more jobs, etc. I mean, this is not a new point, but maybe new in the way it was said. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what we're seeing already in the transition to solar and wind. I believe they're either at or very close to parity with fossil fuels.
It depends where you live, because the cost of renewables varies a lot. And of course, one of the bad things about gas is that because we've been facing an environment with a lot of cheap gas in the last few years, the finances of renewables are not as good as they would have been had we not had all this cheap gas in front of us. But it is true that there have been great advances. The cost of solar is coming down dramatically. And like a lot of things, the more we do it, the more the costs tend to come down. I mean, mass marketing does really work, right? Henry Ford was right about that. So we do seem to be at a place, particularly in some parts of the country like California, where the uptake of solar energy is becoming really quite substantial and costs are coming down dramatically. So I think that's really important. I think that's cause for optimism. But I think it's also important for people to realize that in almost all places where that's happening, there's been some kind of government program to create incentives to do that. If you leave this to the free market on its own, it's very hard for people to justify the switch. There's a lot of upfront investment cost associated with solar, and I know it because I've just put solar on my own house, and we're going to be, you know, net neutral for electricity going forward, but it took a lot of time and it took a lot of money, and not everybody's got that upfront money available. So where we see government incentives, where we see renewable portfolio standards that require utilities to get a proportion of their energy from renewables, we see very significant changes. But in states that don't have renewable portfolio standards or other incentives, the changes are much less great.
So we are airing this just in advance of the biggest people's climate march in history. It's going to happen in New York, and right after that, there are going to be climate talks at the UN next week to talk about the road to the next talks in Paris. I wonder if you could give us some thoughts on the role of social movements in moving forward.
Well, I think one of the things we know from history is that very often leaders don't really lead, they follow. They respond to the will of the people, and that's a good thing. They should respond to the will of the people. We've had a huge leadership vacuum on this issue of climate change, and it's partly because the American people haven't demanded anything different. And the American people are up against the most powerful industry in the history of mankind. So I think it's terribly important that people do take to the streets and the phones and the internet and write letters to congressmen and all the different things that people can do, because if we create enough momentum to say to world leaders, this is not acceptable, you know, you're selling out our future, our children's future, the future of biodiversity, the future of all the amazing plants and animals that we share this planet with, and for what, you know, just for a little more oil and gas for another couple of decades? It's kind of crazy. And so I think this climate march is terrifically important. I'm going to be there. I'll be marching with a group called Protect Our Winters. And if anyone's in New York and wants to join us, you're very welcome. I think it's very important. And I think we've seen this in many ways in the past in the United States. If we think about women's rights or civil rights or the abolition of slavery, the role of activism, the role of movements was hugely important in all of those. And they were partly important because they forced people in leadership positions to begin to act as the leaders that they are supposed to be.
Well, Naomi Oreskes, I'll be looking for you and the people to, what is it called?
Protect Our Winters. It's a group of athletes and winter sports lovers who are calling attention to climate change as an issue for the ski industry, for people who love winter, for people who snowboard. Ski industry is a multi-billion dollar industry. 20 million Americans ski or snowboard. So we're trying to mobilize that as a group of people who haven't in the past typically been involved in environmentalism or might not even really think of themselves as political, but there's something that they care about that is climate sensitive. And so we're raising awareness of climate as an issue for fun, for something that we really love. It's not just all gloom and doom. It's also about protecting things we love.
Mm, that's great. And maple syrup goes along with that.
Maple syrup, absolutely. I would really like to see a Protect Our Maple Syrup group, so maybe we can get that going too.
Okay, well, I'll be looking for you there along with my granddaughter. We're going to be marching. And
terrific. Well, if you see me, please say hello, because I don't know what you look like.
Okay, I will. Thank
terrific.
You so much, Naomi Oreskes. Your wonderful book, The Collapse of Western Civilization, A View from the Future, and I can tell our listeners, it's short and extremely pithy and fascinating. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been great talking with you.
You can go to writersvoice.net to hear a TED Talk by Naomi Oreskes. And after the break, we listen back to my 2010 interview with climatologist Jim Hansen. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. As you heard me say in my conversation with Naomi Oreskes, Dr. James Hansen is a hero of mine. A globally renowned climate scientist, Hansen was the first to alert the world to the threat of climate change when he testified before Congress in 1988. In 2010, Hansen came out with the book Storms of My Grandchildren. Coming up is an extended excerpt from our interview with him about the book. It's a good listen in light of next week's climate summit at the UN. Back in 2009, world leaders set a target limit for global temperatures to rise no more than 2 degrees centigrade. I asked James Hansen if he thought that target was adequate. But the really scary thought in light of his answer is that now we're on a path to rise 4 or 5 degrees centigrade. Here's Hansen's response to the question about 2 degrees centigrade, and you'll notice his prescience about the risk of coastal storms to New York City 2 years before Hurricane Sandy.
Well, we know that that's a disaster scenario. So far, we've had a rise in temperature of 8/10 of 1 degree Celsius, and we already see that the ice sheets on Greenland and Antarctica are not going to be stable on the long run. The rate at which Greenland is losing ice accelerated from 150 cubic kilometers several years ago to 300 cubic kilometers per year now, and likewise Antarctic rate of ice loss has accelerated. 2 degree warming would mean that those ice sheets are unstable and we will get sea level rise of several meters, which would have disastrous consequences. And we would also lose all the mountain glaciers around the world, which provide fresh water for actually billions of people from the rivers that originate in the mountains. And the expansion of the subtropics, which we can already see is affecting the southwest United States and causing the lakes to run dry and forest fires to increase, the Arctic sea ice would all be gone, with the effects that would have on wildlife there and indigenous peoples. So we really, what we've learned in the last few years is that to stabilize climate at a level that the species that we now have on the planet to continue to exist is going to require that we stabilize carbon dioxide at a level of no more than 350 parts per million. And that would be possible if we phase out coal use over the next few decades and if we prohibit unconventional fossil fuels like tar sands.
One thing that seems striking to me is that there's an awful lot of talk about how climate change is going to affect those people over there, but there seems to be an assumption that it's not going to be affecting us here at home. What kind of sea level rise are we likely to see here in the U.S.?
That depends on what time scale we refer to, but that's why I'm concerned particularly about my children and grandchildren, because we can see very well what is going to happen as warming continues and as the ice sheets become more and more unstable. Because what happens is, as the rate of discharge of these icebergs to the ocean increases, we will reach a level at which they begin to cool the North Atlantic and the Southern Ocean around Antarctica. And as the low latitudes continue to get warmer, this increased temperature gradient from the low latitudes to the high latitudes will drive stronger frontal or cyclonic storms, which in extreme cases generate winds comparable to that in hurricanes. When you combine these stronger storms with the rising sea level, we're going to get disasters at coastal cities all along the United States coast and other coastlines, which, because of the populations, I mean, we had a disaster at New Orleans, but that's a relatively small city. Once we start to have storms with storm tides and increasing sea level on large cities, we're going to have social and economic disasters associated with that, which will make New Orleans look like a small thing in comparison. You see, the thing is, it won't require a hurricane. Once you get a nor'easter with rising sea level and with increasing strength in these mid-latitude frontal storms, then you can get a comparable response without an actual hurricane.
Well, you talk about the loading the dice as a metaphor. What is the relationship between that and the frequency of these storms?
Well, I used the dice to illustrate the fact that although natural fluctuations are as yet still larger than the mean rise in temperature, but the perceptive person can notice that the frequency of unusually warm seasons is already beginning to increase. The dice are loaded. The same applies to extremes of the hydrologic cycle. By that I mean, on the one extreme, heavy rainfalls and floods, and on the other extreme, heat waves and droughts. Because as the world gets warmer, the atmosphere can hold more water vapor. That means that when you do have rainfall, you can get heavier rainfall and bigger floods. But at the times and places when it's dry, because of the increased temperature, you get greater drying and higher temperatures. And we can see that the dice are already beginning to be loaded. For example, where I live, we've had two so-called 100-year floods in the last 15 years. And that's the kind of loading of the dice that is going to occur as we continue to push the climate to the more extreme global warming.
You give really what you say is a short course in climatology. We don't have time to go into the kind of detail that you did in the book, which is fascinating. But can you give us some of the highlights of that so that we can understand what are some of the issues here and be able to be more intelligent when people who deny that there's climate change come back with their arguments?
The fundamental thing about climate is the inertia of the system, which is easy to understand because the ocean is 4 kilometers, about 2.5 miles deep. The ice sheets are a couple of miles thick. These things do not change immediately as you begin to apply a forcing to them. And by a forcing, I mean something that alters the planet's energy balance. So, for example, if we add carbon dioxide to the atmosphere, that reduces the heat radiation that the planet is emitting to space because it's like a blanket on the Earth. So it keeps the heat more effectively at the Earth's surface. And that radiation imbalance then causes the ocean to begin to get warmer. As the ocean gets warmer, it melts the ice shelves, which are the tongues of ice that come out from the Antarctic and Greenland ice sheet into the ocean. As the ice sheets begin to melt, that allows the ice streams, the more plastic part of the ice sheets, to begin to discharge their icebergs to the ocean more rapidly. And so this all takes time because, you know, just as your swimming pool doesn't warm up immediately when the sun comes up, it takes a time to absorb the energy and get warmer. But we see this happening. We see the deep ocean getting warmer. We see the ice streams beginning to move faster. They're discharging icebergs more than twice as fast as they were just 10 years ago. So that's why the problem is an intergenerational issue. We are the ones adding the gases to the atmosphere that cause these processes to get started, but it's our children and grandchildren who will bear the brunt of the problem. And that's why it's an issue of intergenerational inequity. It's one that we didn't understand when our parents were beginning this fossil, the heavy fossil fuel use. They didn't realize that they were going to cause problems for future generations. But now the picture has become clear. We realize that we are causing problems for our children and grandchildren if we don't get on a different path. And that's why we have to begin to address it now. The truth is, the things that we need to do make sense for other reasons. Why should we continue to go after the last drops of oil on the Earth and exploit these really dirty, unconventional fossil fuels when they wouldn't last indefinitely anyhow? We're going to need to move on to cleaner energies. So why not do it now and preserve a planet and allow the other species to continue to exist, rather than trying to get the last drop of these fossil fuels?
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with climate scientist Dr. James Hansen. His book is Storms of My Grandchildren. When you say that this takes a long time to unfold, you also point in the book that it's taking an awful lot shorter time than other climate change events in the Earth's history. Because, of course, a lot of the climate deniers say, well, Earth has warmed up before, and it's been just peachy. So explain about these timelines that you say in the book we're doing this about 10,000 times more powerful. The human changes are 10,000 times more powerful than natural climate forcings. So if this is a long time, how come it's so short?
Yeah. Well, it's certainly true. There have been huge climate changes in the Earth's history. If we go back 50 million years, there was no ice on the planet. It was much warmer. Sea level was 75 meters, about almost 250 feet higher than it is now. And, of course, that if you got to that situation, it would be pretty stable. But to get there from here would, of course, flood billions of people out of their homes. And we have lived in a climate, the Holocene, the last 10,000 years, in which the climate has been relatively stable with sea level at the level it is now. And, yeah, the rate at which we are changing carbon dioxide is about 10,000 times faster than the natural rates of increase or decrease that gave rise to these very large but slow changes of the climate during the Earth's history. And civilization developed with the climate that we've had during the last 10,000 years. And unless we want enormous disruptions to civilization, we need to keep the climate roughly within that range that has existed during the last 10,000 years.
Hansen says that we do have some time to turn things around, but to do that, we'll have to get off coal, and fast. You say we need to keep all the coal in the ground, and
yeah,
we need a transition
yeah.
period to get rid, to stop using oil and gas.
Yeah, well, the reason is, first of all, there's more coal. There's more carbon in coal than there is in oil and gas. And the oil and gas are very convenient fuels, which are limited in amount. We've used about half of the oil that we know about. And it's very difficult to see how we could prevent the use of the readily available oil and gas. It's owned by countries like Russia and Saudi Arabia. But coal not only has the most carbon dioxide, but it's also the dirtiest fuel. It's the one that we could decide to leave in the ground. So it's clear, unless you're going to tell, I met with the environment minister of Germany after I'd written a letter to the chancellor, and they agreed that we would have to limit the CO2 emissions and try to get CO2 back below 350 parts per million. But at the same time, they're planning to build more coal plants. And my question then was, well, then how are you going to convince Russia to leave its oil in the ground, its gas in the ground, and how to convince Saudi Arabia to leave its oil in the ground? And, of course, there is no prospect for doing that. So the only practical way to keep CO2 at a level that allows our climate to stay close to what it is now is to phase out coal use. So it simply doesn't make sense to continue to rely on that. Since it's a finite resource anyway, we need to move on to the era beyond fossil fuels.
My final questions have to do with the politics. You were the guy who actually explained climate change to Al Gore, but you write that the Clinton-Gore administration, you say that they were ineffectual in this matter, and you're being polite, that emissions substantially increased. What do you think happened? I mean, Gore understood this. Obama seems to also understand, and yet the talk is greater than the action here. Why?
Well, I think it's largely because of the fact that in Washington, as well as other capitals around the world, money talks, and the fossil fuel industry's got a lot of money. I'm encouraged by the fact that Al Gore, in the Copenhagen discussions, he did clearly state, I believe for the first time, made a clear statement in public that it made more sense to put a price on carbon emissions and to use that money to return it to the public one way or another, either as a payroll tax deduction or as a dividend, as I suggest. The reason I prefer a dividend is we can then very easily see that it equals the amount that was taken in from the fee on carbon. And also half the people are not on payrolls. They're either retired or they're involuntarily out of work. But in any case, he made this clear statement, and also John Kerry made a statement that indicated he was open-minded about that, that didn't necessarily have to be a cap-and-trade with offsets scheme. So the politics is difficult because in our democracies, it's no longer strictly a case of one person, one vote. In many cases, it's $1. One vote.
Right.
Unless we can get campaign finance reform so that we can get money out of politics, it is going to be difficult.
You're hearing an interview I originally aired with climatologist James Hansen in February of 2010 about his book, Storms of My Grandchildren. What do you think about the EPA regulating carbon dioxide? Do you think that that's an end run around the politics? Do you think that's going to work?
Well, it obviously is an end run, and on the short term, it can work and get us moving in the right direction. But it's not the best approach on the long run, because if we get an election and a different administration comes in, they may direct EPA in a different way. So we really need to make the fundamental changes. And as I keep repeating, but the only way to do that is to make the price of fossil fuels gradually rise so that the competition, the clean energies, and the energy efficiency can compete and take over for the fossil fuels, and we move on to a cleaner future for our children and grandchildren.
What would you say now to listeners? You know, I mean, this is the point at which I guess listeners get told that they should call their congressperson, but given that Congress, as you say, you know, is listening more to the dollar votes than the ballot votes, what do you think citizens should do?
Well, I think that next spring is the key time, because now there is this reassessment of what the international response is going to be, because nothing was decided in Copenhagen. But it was actually useful that China and the U.S. did talk together and even signed the final agreed on this final accord, which doesn't have any clear actions in it, but it is going to depend now. The United States is going to have to decide where it is going, and I think if we can have an honest, open discussion about cap and trade with offsets versus an honest price with the funds distributed to the public, I think the public will be able to understand that if we're going to get off fossil fuels, we've got to put a rising price on that. And if the funds that are generated are distributed to the public, they'll go along with that. This is actually a trial of this has occurred in British Columbia, which is working very well. So we need to try it in the United States, I think.
Is this kind of the equal and opposite thing that happens in Alaska, where everybody gets a fossil fuel dividend?
Well, yeah, that dividend came from selling oil, but the dividend I'm talking about would come from taxing the oil and gas and coal at the mine, and that money then being distributed to the public.
So we need to come up with some kind of slogan that can say that well.
Well, the slogan I suggested was 100% dividend or fight. Because Congress, what they want to do, whenever there's a money source, they like to give it to their favorites or to invest it. They like to make decisions about investments like clean coal. That's the marketplace should make the decisions as to what technologies are going to win. If you put a rising price on carbon, then all the competitors will try to give you a lower price. And put the money in the hands of the public and let them invest it where they think is most effective, rather than where Congress wants to put it.
Well, Jim Hansen, Storms of My Grandchildren, The Truth About the Coming Climate Catastrophe and Our Last Chance to Save Humanity. That's the book. Thanks so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice. There is nothing more important, I think, for us to think about, talk about, and act about.
Well, thanks very much for having me on.
Dr. James Hansen is the head of NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies. You can find a link to the group Tar Sands Action at writersvoice.net, as well as a link to the full interview I did with Jim Hansen in 2010. If you want to know more about joining the People's Climate March, go to peoplesclimate.org. The march starts at 11:30 at Central Park West between 65th and 86th Streets. And if you can't make it to New York and want to get involved where you live, check out 350.org. And here's a poem that's apropos of what we've been talking about today. It's Advice to a Prophet by Richard Wilbur.
Advice to a Prophet. When you come, as you soon must, to the streets of our city, mad-eyed from stating the obvious, not proclaiming our fall, but begging us in God's name to have self-pity, spare us all word of the weapons, their force and range, the long numbers that rocket the mind. Our slow, unreckoning hearts will be left behind, unable to fear what is too strange. Nor shall you scare us with talk of the death of the race. How should we dream of this place without us? The sun, mere fire, the leaves untroubled about us, a stone look on the stone's face. Speak of the world's own change. Though we cannot conceive of an undreamt thing, we know to our cost how the dreamt cloud crumbles, the vines are blackened by frost, how the view alters. We could believe, if you told us so, that the white-tailed deer will slip into perfect shade, grown perfectly shy. The lark avoid the reaches of our eye. The jack pine lose its knuckled grip on the cold ledge, and every torrent burn as Xanthus once, its gliding trout stunned in a twinkling. What should we be without the dolphin's ark, the dove's return, these things in which we have seen ourselves and spoken? Ask us, prophet, how we shall call our natures forth, when that lie of tongue is all dispelled, that glass obscured or broken, in which we have said the rose of our love and the clean horse of our courage, in which beheld the singing locust of the soul unshelled, and all we mean or wish to mean. Ask us whether with the wordless rose our hearts shall fail us. Come demanding whether there shall be lofty or long standing when the bronze annals of the oak tree close.
Richard Wilbur reading Advice to a Prophet. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. Then check out my blog, Francesca Rhiannon at blogspot.com. You can find lots of cool stuff there. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.